Welcome to Spawned, a common sense, generally fun, and hopefully helpful discussion on parenting and parenting culture. Hey, I'm Liz Gumbiner.
And I'm Kristen Chase, and we're the founders of CoolMomPicks.com. And today we are happy to welcome back Jordan Shapiro to talk about his new book, Father Figure, How to Be a Feminist Dad. Oh my gosh, this is going to be such an awesome conversation. No pressure,
I know.
But it is.
He's a Spawned listener favorite. Yes. So this is going to be amazing. We can't wait to talk about this. And of course, one of my favorite topics, as you know. And we will close out our show, as always, with our cool picks of the week. And we'll do all that right after this. This episode of Spawned is brought to you by the Panasonic Long Range Baby Monitor, or for you tech geeks, the KXHN410W. How'd I do, Kristen?
So well. I am super impressed.
So if you're a new parent, you know how you just want to know everything is okay in the next room where the baby's sleeping so you can, you know, get a little rest yourself maybe, or at least some peace of mind. The Panasonic Long Range Baby Monitor has so many features that you won't find in other monitors that makes it a really cool registry gift or even just a smart purchase for yourself.
You can set it up and then see everything on the portable 3.5-inch color monitor. And with a touch of a button, you can pan, tilt, and zoom the companion camera so you can check in on your baby at any time, even from 1,500 feet away. That's actually 4 football fields for you data nerds, so please don't put your baby to sleep 4 football fields away.
That sounds like a Ted Lasso season 2 kind of. Parents really like the extra long battery life. I remember those days, which allows you to listen to up to 13 hours of standby time and 5 hours of continuous baby time. But because it's designed to help babies actually fall asleep and stay asleep too, you may never need those 5 hours, let's hope. You can actually soothe them with the gentle soothing built-in sounds that includes 5 types of white noise and a whole selection of lullabies. It's all built right into the monitor. Or you can use the secure 2-way talking and listening feature to just gently reassure your baby with your very own voice. And we know how much babies love that.
And if that weren't enough, the monitor system has built-in sensors with customizable alerts. So, you know, whether there's a change in temperature, motion, or sound that you need to address, you can do it. It's really reassuring. But what's really awesome is that even with all of these smart, high-tech features, the Panasonic Long Range Baby Monitor is so easy to set up and use, which we know it's a big deal when you're a new parent, or like any parent, but especially new parents. You're not getting a lot of sleep. There's no Wi-Fi required for a connection, which means wherever you bring it, you can just plug it in and go. And yes, you can bring it anywhere, in or outside the home. Actually, even on a football field.
I'll tell you the story sometime about bringing my baby to a football game. Another time, Kristen. To learn more about the Panasonic Long Range Baby Monitor, you can find it right on Amazon or grab the link on the Cool Mom Picks podcast page for this episode. We'll have all the information right there. It's the Panasonic Long Range Baby Monitor. Fantastic registry gift. Please check it out.
So, Liz, what is it about having dad authors multiple times on Spawned? We've had James Breakwell, Rob Wilder, and now Jordan Shapiro.
Well, I would say we like the dads. We like supporting the dads. But you know what? We like supporting the dads that support us. So maybe there's something to that.
Yes, listen,
to those of you who don't know, even though you should by now, Jordan Shapiro, who's going to be our guest today, PhD Jordan Shapiro, is an international speaker, thought leader, Temple University instructor, an expert advisor to the World Economic Forum, and a consultant whose fresh perspective combines psychology, philosophy, and economics in unexpected ways. He's a senior fellow for the Joan Ganz Cooney Center at Sesame Workshop and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institute. Very impressive. In the Center for Universal Education. And hey, he's a dad of 2. And Kristen, a Philly resident like you.
Yes, yes. But our listeners may best know him for his book, The New Childhood, Raising Kids to Thrive in a Connected World, which changed the cultural conversation about parenting and screen time. And our interview with him right here on Spawned has been a listener favorite, both with the Spawned community and in our OutTech Your Kids community. And well, he's shifted direction from digital parenting with his brand new book, Father Figure, How to Be a Feminist Dad, which is out on May 11th, and it's already been given the coveted starred reviewed status from Publishers Weekly.
Bravo!
Yay! Clapping! Yay! In the book, he offers a norm-shattering, overdue perspective on fatherhood, family, gender roles, and masculinity in the 21st century, complete with references to Star Wars, Homer Simpson, and Michael Ian Black. And we are so excited to jump right in. Welcome back, Jordan.
Welcome, Jordan.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I'm so glad to be a part of this. Thank you for having me.
We are thrilled. I mean, when we were like, Jordan is writing a book about dads and feminism, I'm like, give me that galley. Give it to me now. This is like my candy. Inject it directly into my veins. This is like right up my alley. I'm so excited. So first, listen, before we get into anything, how old are your kids now? I feel like they're my kids' ages, and I just want to know how they're doing in general with all that's going on in the world.
Well, they're all teenagers, two of my own and two stepkids, and they range in ages from 12 to 15. I think they're all doing well. Nobody's complaining too much. I think their response to the pandemic was, oh, cool, nothing interrupts our video game time anymore. We don't have to go to school and stop being online.
Says the guy who's like, video games are fine. Yes, in a world-changing book.
No, I mean, they certainly had their struggles. They certainly miss a lot of the social interactions. They often do say, I wish this whole pandemic was over. But overall, to me, they seem pretty happy and pretty healthy. And it's been a fun family time. And it's been a stressful family time, mm-hmm. as I'm sure it is for everyone.
Well, mm-hmm. I appreciate the honesty. Yeah. And I'm glad they're doing relatively well. I know, like, everyone's kind of on the continuum of struggles in their own way. And it sounds like you're managing it pretty well. So I'm very glad to hear that. So listen, Jordan, as you know, you are one of our favorite guests. And I personally credit you for changing my entire perspective on screen time and digital parenting, as I say often on this podcast and in all of our Facebook groups. So I'm excited to hear about how you're going to make me think differently now about feminism and gender from a dad perspective.
Oh my goodness, that's a lot of pressure.
You've already done it.
I changed your thinking about screen time. Now I got to change your thinking about gender equality. I don't know if I'm up to it.
Yes, you listen, I can learn something from everybody, even you.
Yes.
But listen, we don't hear a lot about mm-hmm. this topic from male authors. I mean, we know some dads in the dad blogging community who do talk about this stuff, but like not so much in the big author space like you. So what made you want to tackle this?
Oh, I mean, I think there's a bunch of different things that made me want to do it. I mean, I've always sort of had the dream of like writing a serious book about feminism by a man. I mean, there's very few. There's a few here and there, but none of them that did it in a very mainstream way the way I'm doing it. And that was always sort of a dream in the back of my head and had no idea how I would make it work. But this one came in particular because while I was promoting The New Childhood and I was traveling the world and I was talking to parents and I was talking to experts and going, hey, here's how you think about parenting, I just immediately noticed, you know, that there was a kind of dad stigma, and to make things worse, a divorced dad stigma, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm divorced, right? People would look at me and go, well, how could you know anything about parenting if you're divorced? Or how could you really be an expert on parenting if you're a dad? You know, it's like men are allowed to be the expert as the doctor on family, right? The authority figure, that we often have that, which is problematic. Mm-hmm. But nobody thinks it's okay for dads to kind of speak about parenting in a way where they combine intuition and experience and sort of create this my personal experience narrative and then combine that, of course, with expertise, which is what I was doing in The New Childhood, but just discovered that people didn't look at it right. This book came out of how do we show what's really going on inside of a father identity? And then it very quickly became clear that I didn't even know what a father identity was and that the idea of gendered parenting was really, really weird and confusing and did it even make any sense? And by the time I was done, it was really a question about how many of the things that we consider to be essential fatherhood attributes are really examples of misogyny or just upholding a patriarchal world order or whatever. And so that was ultimately how it evolved to becoming the How to Be a Feminist Dad book.
Ooh. And I just have to point out, I loved that you acknowledged up front in the book, you're like, I wanted to be careful that I wasn't doing this to virtue signal. And that's a term I've got all kinds of issues with. I think you do too. but that you're like, I'm not trying to get basically like my sensitive ponytail man crowd here. Like this is something I'm really concerned about and mm-hmm. interested in mm-hmm. and from an academic and a personal standpoint. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was certainly not about that. I mean, I think I already have a pretty good hippie dad ponytail rep, right? So
well, now it's beard rep. I feel like it's pandemic beard rep versus the ponytail.
That's a Gen X reference from Singles, by the way, if you didn't catch that. They refer to one of the characters as Sensitive Ponytail Man.
But no, yeah, I absolutely did not want it to be that. I mean, not just because I didn't want people to think, hey, you're just writing this to get the accolades or the credit, but also because I really, you know, how do you be a man who benefits from male privilege and white privilege and cisgender privilege and hetero cisgender privilege? Like, how do you write that in a way where you're not walking in? This was one of the biggest challenges to me, and going, hey, I'm going to be an authority on feminism. Like that would go against the whole point.
Exactly. Right? Listen, exactly. There, little lady. Let me tell you a little something about feminism.
Right, let me tell you a little something about feminism.
Buy the audiobook so you don't chip your nails while you turn the pages.
Exactly. So that was it. That was, I think that's part of what I was getting at with, like, the, you know, like, this is not really about me.
Right. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up divorce, which I imagine no one says ever. Does anyone ever say, I'm glad you brought up divorce? But I'm going to say it because you brought that up, and, you know, you're co-parenting your kids and now you're step-parenting your partner's kids. And, you know, we are all in that situation. Actually, both Liz and I are, you know, we actually, there's a lot of synchronicity in our experiences with you, Jordan. But I'm wondering, how do you think that change in your situation, right? You've had a couple, actually, since we last talked to you, have helped shape your views or at least help you see things differently from a gender role perspective?
You know, a question like this is kind of hard because can you really say that there's one thing that is singularly responsible for shifting the way you think about things? You know, these thinking habits of mind, that's always sort of a holistic thing. But certainly, I think, you know, pre-divorce, I couldn't have written this book. There's lots of things I learned while writing this book that I was a pretty bad husband during my first marriage. I did a lot of things bad. I was a bad father in some ways, or at least a bad co-parent. Maybe I wasn't a bad father. I don't know if I was bad to my kids, but I was certainly not a good partner in the parenting process. And I think part of it is just, you know, a lot of self-reflection on that mm-hmm. that made a difference. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like there's a sort of hint in your question that maybe once I was responsible for the kids half the time and then started having an understanding of how hard it was, things shifted. I don't know if that's what you're getting at. But you know what?
For what it's worth, I mean, I can just answer the question from my perspective. When my kids' dad and I split up like eight-ish years ago, I remember seeing some changes where, like, parents would acknowledge to me, like, I actually wouldn't let my kids go to his apartment alone as a male. And I was like, what? Huh? Yeah. Like, so there were things like that, like, made me, like, I wouldn't have been aware of that when we were together quite as much. And I don't know if you faced anything like that, like, made you go, whoa, I really see the difference in the role when you're single versus when you can, like, kind of lean on, like, I've got a lady at home.
Well, and you know what? Also, I don't necessarily feel like it's a negative, right? Like, I get that there is sort of this feeling of, like, I was left to parent my children half the time and I had to figure it out. Like, I was left in the wilderness with, like, you know, some flint and a machete. But more like, you know, there are some positives, I think, in that, right? Because I feel like, and, you know, this is very gendered talk, but I feel like there is this group of women, right, who feel like, I know what I'm doing. I'm going to do things my way. My partner doesn't know as much as I do. And the way that he does things is not as good or not great or not right.
And sometimes they're right, by the way.
Sometimes they're right, but sometimes, you know, I think a lot of the times they're wrong, right? And I think when you are separate and parenting in separate circumstances, you actually get a chance to be like, oh, wait, hey, I'm good at this. Like, I did know what I was doing. I just wasn't good at doing it together with that person, right? So I don't know if it's so much of like, now I know how hard it is, but also is it more of like how much I enjoy this, how much this is more beneficial to me or whatever than I thought it was. So it's not necessarily a negative per
se. I think that's true. I think to sort of say back what you just said, which now that I hear you say it, it's really occurring to me, is that when you're married, there's so many things where you rely on the other person to sort of take part of the intellectual, you know, you play that role, you do that kind of thinking, I do this kind of thinking, even in memory, right? Like some people are supposed to remember some half the events and the other person remembers the other events, who remembers the restaurant you loved in that city, who remembers the birthdays, right? Those kind of things. And so I think if anything, being divorced really made me, you know, you have to think about all those things that you've sort of left that to other people. So I think in terms of the psychological self-reflection, mm-hmm. there are a lot of times I got to ignore it while I was married because it would just, you know, she'd make it work. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. after that, I really had to look at myself and go, if no one's here to like make it work and pretend that I'm perfect, then I have to acknowledge that I'm not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that leads me to this question about, you know, speaking of perfect dads or good dads, good enough dads, you had a line in the intro that really stayed with me. You wrote, many men today find themselves paralyzed as they confront conflicting messages. To go all in on feminism seems to betray the customary good dad story. To go all in on the prevailing good dad story undoubtedly betrays feminism. I know that sounds like very philosophical, but like, why don't you explain kind of what you meant by that? Because that was, I really spent a lot of time on that.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to give a quick answer to. And in some ways, that's what the whole book tries to pack. I mean, let's start with the customary good dad story. And so much of the book is about this. So many of these things that we think of as the good dad and we try to be good dad, whether this is men or women or gender nonconforming folks, right? When we imagine what it means to be a good father, we have certain tropes in our head. We have certain expectations, certain ideas about what that looks like, what kind of warmth there is, what kind of authority there is in that individual, what kind of caretaking they do, what, you know, all the things that we imagine when we go, daddy knows best or whatever. And as I started to unpack all of those, I realized that many of those things, which come from a place of compassion and warmth and stewardship and caretaking, were reinforcing misogyny, reinforcing patriarchy, reinforcing this notion of male supremacy in really subtle and inadvertent ways. And so the idea was to be a good dad, right, betrays feminism then. Mm-hmm. And then to be feminist means you have to like give up a lot of all the things that we've all been told make you a good dad for years. And that's really a kind of paralyzing position to be in because we don't have an image for an alternative.
That's heavy. And I think a lot about how the good dad trope or whatever, however you want to describe it, right, is reinforced by society. It's reinforced even by women, right? And I think of like the dad who's taking his child to the playground, like that's some big magnanimous gesture, right? It's like, look at him.
Oh, yes. Babysitting your kids.
He took his child to the playground. Oh, a shoe fell off and he put it back on. Yay. You know, and I think we're all perpetuating that when we're all like, oh my God, look at him. Like he's wearing his baby, like in a baby carrier. Like my kids, my oldest is what, like almost 17. And I am now, it's taken that long for me to see a dad in a baby carrier and not even think twice and not even in my head say, what a good dad, right? Like, look at him. He's holding his child like everyone. One would. And, you know, so it's ingrained.
Amanda showed me a picture of someone the other day, a man holding a baby carrier. And she's like, look, it's an image of a feminist dad. I'm like, that's not a feminist dad. I had my kids in a baby carrier and I was doing tons of terrible things at the same time.
Nice. Yes. You holding your child does not define you.
Well, when you talk about that trope, you actually explain that the way we think about fatherhood comes from religious sermons, television commercials, bad science, that there are these arbitrary cultural expectations that are perpetuated in all these different ways. So can you elaborate on that? Like, what are some of the arbitrary ideas so we can be aware of them? And when we hear them, maybe push back against that.
Yeah. I guess the way to first look at that is to just think about entertainment, number one, right? I cover a lot in the book talking about Star Wars, for example, which is even a kind of subtle mythological version of it with like Darth Vader, the bad dad. And we have to have this like hero fights the dad villain story, which is so deeply ingrained and comes from Freud's Oedipus complex.
Right.
I also talk about other kinds of science fiction shows like Star Trek or Battlestar Galactica with the like captain in this paternal role and how everyone deals with them and the way that they are supposed to demonstrate authority with a kind of father knows best warmth and stoicism at the same time. Mm. I mean, you think of any sitcom, sometimes we get the like bumbling idiot dad, but is still the man of the house, the sort of Homer Simpson, right?
The dad on the Goldbergs is, I think, is a good example too, right?
Yeah. Right. They still make the final decisions, of course, mm-hmm. right? But everybody mm-hmm. thinks they're such idiots until the moment when the decision has to get made. And then with a snap of their finger, they solve everything, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I've been lately, since I wrote the book, I've been binge watching a lot of old shows. Like, I've recently watched all of the OC again. And you've got Sandy Cohen, who I think of as just the bad good dad. Like, everything about him seems right. His ethics are right. His morals are right. But he lies to everyone with this notion that he has to fix everything secretly behind everyone's back.
As if he's
the real authority of everyone. And like, every problem is like a lie he didn't tell his wife or something he didn't tell his children because he was trying to protect them. And all of that is this sort of entertainment. We see it in books. We see it in commercials. We see it in everything. But then what happens, and you brought up the religious narratives and the bad science, is that we use religion or we use bad science, evolutionary, you know, nonsense evolutionary science, not real evolutionary science. They're like, you know, they're like, we're all still have lizard brain.
Men are meant to spread their seed through many partners. Women are meant to be monogamous.
Absurdity. Yeah. But that's a perfect example because that's what I'm talking about. We use that to naturalize these notions that the bad good dad is somehow normal, natural, taken for granted how things should be. And they get combined together into this thing that then we're all like, there's something wrong with me if I'm not that.
Well, you're really peeling away the layers of the onion here. And I know that this isn't a digital parenting book, but it is parenting, but I see the similarities because I feel like you did that in The New Childhood too. You really pulled back the layers of the onion. And I feel like, I don't know, even I am finding myself, you know, when I read this book and now even hearing you talk about it, that you see how much of what you've been surrounded with is biased and patriarchal and misogynist. And it's hard even as a woman to find my footing because it's like what I'm used to hearing. It's what we're used to seeing, and pushing back against that is difficult. What needs to happen where it doesn't feel so jarring to hear all of this? Because we're surrounded. Like, it's everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, what we need to do is we need to normalize the conversation. And I think in a lot of ways that's really happening in a way it hasn't before. That's part of what made me want to write Father Figure, is like, it's pretty hard to turn on like a single news cycle without hearing someone call out someone else for not being woke enough, right? You know, they call that cancel culture if you're not on my side of this conversation. but it's everywhere. It's sort of a conversation we didn't used to have. It was sort of limited to, you know, hardcore feminists and academia. That's now everywhere. And that alone was what made me go, hey, you know what? Like, that's got to be really hard for a lot of men, right?
Yeah.
To be just, so you turn it on and you just hear misogyny, patriarchy all day long, and you don't even understand it.
Yeah.
You don't really understand what's being called out. You can't see it around you. And so, you know, I wrote this book because I looked around and saw so many people that went, why? You know, so many men going, why are they keep calling me a supervillain? And they thought that it was so black or white. It was like, I mean to do good things and you still call me misogynist. And they couldn't reconcile the fact that you might have all the best intentions in the world and still be reinforcing problematic ways of being. And I wanted to kind of open that up and go, hey, one, you're not a supervillain. You just don't understand everything. Here's how I can help you see what everybody is talking about, and make you realize that actually many of the things that they're mad at are things you wouldn't do if you really thought them through, because mm-hmm. you want to be good. Mm-hmm. You care about your kids. You care about, you know, that's the joke. It's like you ask almost any man, how do you feel about gender equity? And they'll go, I'm all for it. Then you go, how do you feel about feminism? They go, oh, not that extreme.
Right, right.
I know, it's so fascinating. Bad that people might want like equity in the world.
But which is just evidence of a deep misunderstanding, right? Because all feminism is a call for gender equity and the end of exploitation and oppression, which I think most people are for.
And you know, it's interesting because as we think of some of the things that are so ingrained that we don't even think about it, like, okay, I'm going to get super meta here. But now we're talking about how dads have traditionally not been or been trained to or been talked to about being more introspective about how they are as a parent and their gender role. Well, women, I think as mothers, have been socialized to like question everything we do, beat ourselves up, we're doing it all wrong, lean on each other, like complain together, think of ourselves as like bad moms, we need to do better. Like, we're so hard on ourselves, so we're the ones reading all the parenting books.
Yeah, it's true.
So of course dads aren't seeing stuff that they're doing wrong. They're not diving into it headfirst like moms are, like beating themselves up all day about like, oh, I wasn't a great dad today. Is that just one stereotype? Am I wrong here?
I mean, I don't know if you're wrong about whether or not they are doing it. I do know, and I cover a couple studies in Father Figure that show that, you know, one thing we know for sure is that men are much more likely now to be involved in childcare and to spend time with their kids and to do some of the parenting. We also know that men are much more likely to see dad as a key identity signifier, right? For most men, dad comes before professional identity. What we also know is they don't feel like they're doing a good job at it. Women are much more likely to think they're doing a good job. And what we also know is that even if they see that as like the primary part of their identity, the caretaking labor has barely shifted at all in decades, that it's still almost all on women.
And you're so not judgy about this, which I love. Like,
yes.
I can hear it talking to you that you just are like, hey, this is just how it is. And we're learning and we're, you know, figuring it out and we're talking to each other. And I love that. And I think that really comes across in the book that it's just, you're not judgy. I think you acknowledge that it's hard out there for dads, that our narratives are changing quickly. It can be hard to keep up with all these changes. I like the structure of the book where you lay out these four foundational principles of becoming what you call a feminist dad. And by the way, you also acknowledge that's not an identity. It's just something we should be. Can you just take us briefly through those four foundational principles?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess I'll give you the list and then I'll explain them all. The four principles, the first one is you need to be committed to cultivating critical consciousness. The second one is you need to practice responsive fathering. The third one is you have to eliminate what I call locker room gender essentialism. And the fourth one is you need to be committed to radical inclusivity. So let me explain what they mean. The first one is a commitment to cultivating critical consciousness. Now, I stole the term critical consciousness from Paulo Freire, who's a famous Brazilian educator. And the way he thought about it was we all are living in certain kinds of systemic patterns that are actually disempowering, right? So we might believe we're only capable of certain roles. We believe that certain structures are the norm, and we have to be always unpacking them, always understanding how our sense of self and our sense of aspiration and our objectives in lives are always situated within some deep, deep system that holds different power relationships. And so we have to be committed to interrogating that and interrogating our actions. And we also have to be committed as fathers who want to be feminist dads to teaching our kids to be doing that all the time. That means when you're watching TV with your kids and you see like clear sexual objectification of women, you call it out and you tell them it's there. That doesn't mean you can't sit and enjoy TV, right? It just means you might be like, well, I liked that show, but it had a lot of I just been doing this with my kids all summer during the pandemic. I'm like, you know what? Queen's Gambit was really, really, really awesome and fun to watch, but why is she sexualized so much?
Right.
I don't understand, right?
Yeah.
Right. Like, we can have both at the same time. We can be like, that was entertaining, and also go, there's a lot of problematic stuff in there. And you have to do that. And by doing it that way, I hope that my kids are learning to be able to sit with that, where every time someone calls out problematic stuff, they don't go, oh no, you're ruining my favorite show, right? They're learning, oh, you can have both at the same time, which is critical consciousness. The second principle is responsive fathering, which might as well be responsive parenting, because by the time you read the book, I think you understand that there's not really a good argument for gendered parenting roles, right? There's no reason for us to think there's a man's parenting role and a woman's parenting role. We all have parenting roles and we're all going to do them our unique way. But I still use responsive fathering because it's a book for dads. And responsive fathering is really about being, you know, what it sounds like, being willing to respond to your circumstances rather than dictate or define them, right? So most fathers have learned, one, you know, in this father knows best mindset, that we get to control the narrative of the whole family. We're the authority of the family. We're the protagonist of the family, and everything else is sort of a supplemental character, right? Wife is a supplemental character to hero dad, right? who's hero dad until Luke Skywalker comes and defeats him, right? Who's the son. And so responsive fathering for me really means acknowledging, you know, that we're living in a world of colliding myths and everybody's the protagonist of their own story. And you're definitely the hero of your own story, but you're probably the mentor in someone else's and the villain in another person's. And that's just a fact. You can't escape that. So don't get pissed off when your kids don't see it as revolving around you, or your wife doesn't see it as revolving around you, or in the example I like to give, which is so close to this book, I think a lot of men are like, wait, I'm the hero. I'm trying to make the world a better place. And then they turn on the TV and they hear that they're a misogynist supervillain. And they're like, I can't be hero and villain at the same time. Well, yeah, you can. And you are. We all are. Everybody is.
Yeah.
For some people. So that's two. Number three is eliminating what I call locker room gender essentialism. I like to call it locker room gender essentialism because in the chapter where I really talk about it, I talk about being in middle school in the locker room. And like, as all of my friends started to feed me these so-called facts about boys and girls, right? Like, boys are always horny. Girls just want relationships. Girls don't even, you know, all this nonsense that's like made no sense. You know, as a middle schooler, I believed it, but it makes no sense. There's no studies to back it up. You know, gender essentialism at its most basic just means the assumption that there is something essential that ties gender to sex. And all the research has shown that that's not true, right? There's no female brain. There's no male brain, right? My penis doesn't make me think certain ways. My penis doesn't even think, although we always say you think with your...
This is groundbreaking information that we are releasing here on Spawned today.
But all that stuff like reminds me of middle school, and it's just in the way, right? Every time we try to say women are one way, men are another way, and that's essential in some way, all we're trying to do is to, again, naturalize the status quo. We're trying to make an argument that the current power system is inevitable and can't be changed. And that's just not true. Mm-hmm. It's changed a million times. There's nothing about the way that we organize gender in this world that would make any sense to my great-grandmother. So like, it can keep changing and there is no natural. Mm-hmm. You just have to eliminate that. And at home, that might mean just doing the obvious everyday things like who washes the dishes and who cooks the food? Who does the laundry, right? Like, are you doing those things in your household because the other person is better at it or because you think that's supposed to be a certain gender job? And, or because you didn't think about it at all, you just did what felt right. You have to be willing to interrogate that. And then the last one, which I think is actually the key one, is what I call radical inclusivity, which is this idea that this isn't even just about sort of cisgender equality, right? This is about inclusivity all the way around. Every single human being, well, maybe even non-human beings, deserve a life of dignity. Mm-hmm. And we have to be committed to modeling for our kids our commitment to letting everyone have that dignity. That extends far beyond cisgender issues. That extends to race and ethnicity and religion and socioeconomic, you know, I'm sure if we wanted to list them, we could come up with like 100 different things that could apply to. You have to be modeling that for your kids at all times, going, I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure I'm never robbing anyone else of their dignity or freedom. That doesn't mean we don't all do those things inadvertently or by accident, or that we, you know, are going to go to hell the second we do, but it does mean we have to be committed to constant self-interrogation to acknowledge when we do things and to do them differently next time.
This is amazing. And I know it's a lot to take in all at once for our listeners, but I just want to like reinforce something. Like, even though you're saying like, we have to do this and this and this and this, one of the things that's so special about the book is it's not judgmental, and that you don't feel like I'm doing everything wrong when you read it. You feel like, oh, if I open my eyes and I open my heart, I can learn things. If I'm willing to kind of put my ego aside and just, you know, think these things through, I might grow as a person. And I just very much like that perspective.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because I definitely wrote Father Figure with the idea that almost everyone I talked to wanted to already be doing all these things, but hadn't quite figured out how.
So then here's my question, because I know you wrote the book for fathers, it's about fathers, but most of our listeners are women and moms at that, mostly. So what do you think we can do as moms to help advance these ideas for and with the dads in our kids' lives?
Oh, the first thing you can do is you should buy this book. Go right now. Go on Amazon.
Funny you should ask that question.
I mean, I think there's two things I think that come to mind immediately. One is, as you said, not to be so judgmental. That doesn't mean not to call out injustice. Absolutely, you should call out injustice. And absolutely, moms should use their voice to call out misogyny and patriarchy and all the inequality all day long. And they shouldn't allow that to be silenced. But they should also recognize what a struggle it is for men, you know, who have so much privilege to try to figure out how to let go of that. They've been systematically socialized to believe that they're in charge and allowed to have these behaviors. And there has to be some level of acknowledgement of what's lost for them as we move to a post-patriarchal world. That's not to say that they're a victim of anything. That's just to say, like, anytime you lose something that was so central to who you are, that's a hard struggle. And just acknowledge that. It doesn't mean it's not a struggle you still have to deal with. It doesn't mean it's a struggle that men can get out of. But we have to acknowledge it's still kind of to be painful, mm-hmm. no matter what. Mm-hmm. And it's right, and it should happen, and that pain should be experienced. But let's also have some empathy that pain is pain, and pain hurts, even if it's hurt you deserve.
Which is why you drop in all the Star Wars and Homer Simpson references, too, so we can, like, laugh and enjoy our way through the book also. Like, as smart yeah. and erudite as you are, it's just, it's also a fun read. Like, it's a really enjoyable book. And I love that I'm raising kids at a time in the world
yes.
where a book like this can just be out and be published by a major publisher and be in existence. It's really cool. So mm-hmm. thank you for that, Jordan.
Yeah, I mean, that's yeah. worth actually calling out Little Brown Spark for their willingness to take a risk on this, because, you know, one of the conversations we had over and over again is, can a book like this exist in the world? Is there a market for the book like this, right? You know, can you put feminism on the cover of a book about dads, right? Like these are all things that are not normal and not to be taken for granted. I appreciate everyone who's been willing to go, you know what, it's time mm-hmm. for us to take mm-hmm. that kind of risk. It's not easy. I mean, when I was first talking to publishers and marketing departments and all of it, one thing you hear all the time is that most books are bought by women. Even books for men tend to be bought by women. That's mm-hmm. just the fact of the market.
Well, we're excited to get we got our hands on it, but we're so excited for our listeners to get their hands on this. And it comes out May 11th, but we know as authors ourselves how important pre-orders are, right? List.
Yeah. Like, and by the way, if you have a husband or male partner who reads this, that could be a great Mother's Day gift for you.
Yes. But you know what? I should also point out that it's a great Father's Day gift. And we have a bunch on my website, feministdadbook.com, of bundles that will arrive in time for Father's Day that include, along with a signed copy of the book, it also includes things like men's boxer shorts with the word feminist plastered across the ass.
I like the way it. You think.
My personal favorite is I have two favorites. One, we have a whole set of buttons and bumper stickers that I call Feminist Toxic Masculinity. And it says things like, isn't it time to man up to feminism? Most of them are dirtier than that, but I decided to give you the clean one.
Oh, my inner copywriter really appreciates
yes,
that.
We both.
So
really
in addition
that.
To Feminist Dad Book, Jordan, where else is it best for people to find you if they want to hear more about what you're doing these days? I know I love following you on Twitter.
Yes, Twitter. Well, on all the social media platforms, I'm at Jordosh, J-O-R-D-O-S-H. And then you can always go to jordanshapiro.org or feministdadbook.com. All roads will lead to me.
Fabulous. I really hope people do. And like the book aside, you're just such a joy to follow on social. I just love what you have to say and the links you share, and like, you're our people, so we're glad you're back again.
Yes, well, the feeling certainly goes all the way around, and like, you know, for everyone who's listening who didn't hear the like lead up to this call when they were like, okay, we have to behave, will you shut up so that we can start recording.
We sometimes tell people that, like, you know, when we share on Instagram our podcasts and we say, like, we could have talked all day. Actually, we did talk for another hour after we stopped recording. And it's true.
We actually
we love
did.
Our guests.
Yes.
And we spent a lot of time talking to them after we stopped recording,
right.
which is really awesome.
And I'm counting back to, like, how long between, like, vaccinations and when it's warm out that we can find our way to your house, Jordan. So that's definitely happening.
You're always welcome. I'll wear my feminist cooking apron and cook you dinner.
Yay! That's awesome.
I'll be like, oh, I was just passing through Philly, you guys. That's so funny to run into you here in the backyard.
With my copy of your book and all of your books. Well, listen, we will link up everything, of course, on our podcast page. And it's one of our favorite parts of the podcast. It's time for
Cool Picks of the Week. Cool Picks of the Week.
And Jordan, it's your turn. You're our guest. You get to go first.
Oh, okay. My pick of the week, I was watching on Hulu, Kid 90, which is the Soleil Moonfry documentary that she made of all the home movies she took with all the 90s kid stars. And she just tells their story. And it is like both really thought provoking, you know, what does fame mean to a kid? What is and what were the 90s? But also just a like nostalgic ride down memory lane as you watch like Leonardo DiCaprio and Mark Wahlberg at like 14 years old hanging out together.
Oh my gosh.
Video.
That's so topical. article now, too, with people talking about the Britney documentary and that incredible article that Mara Wilson wrote about being a child actress in the 90s. Like, that sounds good. I would like to watch that.
I recommend it. You'll enjoy it.
Very good. Well, I am not recommending anything that you watch, but you can use it while you watch. So, Kristen, you know, lately I've been kind of paring down the pandemic stash, like what products I want to keep after this and which ones were just like a crazy late night I'm bored purchase.
Okay.
And one of the things I bought that I love, there's a brand called Tatcha, T-A-T-C-H-A. It's a Japanese beauty brand, and they make this face mask called the Violet C Radiance Mask. And it's like one of those things I've kind of had around for a while and I haven't used, and I finally tried it. It is the best face mask I've ever tried.
Whoa.
I love it so much.
Okay.
You like goop it on your face. It's purple. You look ridiculous. You turn on Hulu for a while. You wipe it off, and your skin feels magical.
Okay.
It's really nice.
All right.
I want one of these. I'm going to try it.
Well,
yeah,
maybe
do
we'll
it.
Send you one in exchange for more books that we can give to all the men in our lives.
I like that. I love that. That's so nice. We'll give you a face mask. Just write another book, Jordan.
It really is good. So anyway, it's from Tatcha, plus cool Japanese brand. And we're hyper aware of Asian-owned brands these days and how we can support them. And so I really like Tatcha. Excellent company.
Yes.
Can I ask a question? I think last time I was on, one of you said your pick was pea milk. Are you still drinking that?
That would be Kristen.
Oh, that would be me. You know what? I actually am drinking, this is hilarious, pea milk protein shakes is my new thing. So the pea milk, I couldn't get anyone to drink the pea milk in my house.
And it's not peeing in the milk, listeners.
It's P-E-A.
It's like made of peas.
Right, P-E-A. So, wow. But since I don't drink a lot of milk, so it's like for me just to get that on my own, but I do drink protein shakes. So I have bought pea milk protein shakes. Why? Did you jump on the pea milk wagon?
No, I just remembered it as we were talking.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sure I tried pea milk once or twice because I like to use the fake milk. We're not supposed to call it fake milk. We're supposed to call it like veggie milk or
I don't know.
Milk alternative. I like it better in my tea than I like cow's milk. Mm-hmm. I just feel like it's like I really like cashew milk in my tea. I think it adds a nutty flavor. So I think I did after we did this podcast last time, I tried the pea milk in my tea, but I think I just went back to cashew because it's cheaper.
So look, that's your second cool pick of the week. We got a lucky strike.
Oh, yeah.
Extra.
Look at cashew you. Milk. Kid 90 and a little cashew milk on the side.
So how about you, Kristen?
Well, Liz, I'm glad you brought up supporting Asian-run businesses right now because that is my cool pick of the week. You just kindly and generously wrote up these beautiful necklaces from one of our longtime favorite designers, Peggy Lee. And what we love that she's doing, which is amazing, is the two necklaces. One that honors the year of the ox, the other is a fortune cookie, and both 100% of the proceeds for each of these pieces of jewelry go to support important causes that are aimed at fighting anti-Asian racism, because it is at an all-time high right now. It's very, 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 very bad, and we need to do something about it. And I'm so glad that you wrote this post, and I know we've shared a lot on Instagram. You know, my mom is Chinese, my ancestors are Chinese, and it's painful to think that there are my family members that are afraid to go outside. Like, this has got to stop. And so I love that Peggy Lee is doing this. You know, of course, we'll link everything up on our site. I bought the fortune cookie necklace.
Aww.
Yeah. And I can't believe she's donating 100% of the proceeds. That's super generous. And
she does that a lot. She has quite a few pieces that she develops specifically for causes. And because she's Chinese American herself, she knew she wanted to do something for this. And even before the horrible events in Atlanta, she came out with this. So I love what she's doing too.
Is there a fortune in the fortune cookie?
No, but she has a cute description about like bringing your own luck and carrying it around with you everywhere.
Yeah.
It's like nice. It like kind of came from a conceptual place, like how special Chinatown was to her growing up in San Francisco and to her parents when they emigrated. So I suppose you could maybe somehow write your own. And I don't know if you can actually put it in there, but that's interesting.
It doesn't matter. I'm going to go look at it because I think it sounds cool. A fortune cookie necklace. I might wear one.
And they're very affordable. They're nice pieces.
Yeah, I mean, there's just something lovely about this idea of, you know, carrying a
around, you know, you write your own fortune in a way, right? Like you create your own destiny. And, you know, Chinatown is very special to my family. I don't know if I've talked about, I may have spoken about this, but my great grandfather was the second American born Chinese person in Washington, D.C. and owned restaurants. He was like formative with Washington, D.C. Chinatown. You know, we want everyone to be safe. Everyone should be able to be safe where they live, where they are, and supported in what they do. And like you said, Jordan, like, you know, we should honor and everyone should have the ability to be themselves and be who they are and be supported in that. Anyway, this is an important cause. And we, of course, will make sure that everything is available to everybody on coolmompics.com. And we'll continue to cover stories, you know, that are important to people. I mean, like, whether it's about the Asian American community or it's about feminism and fatherhood, like, this is what we do, right, Liz? Like, this is what we do.
Yeah. Cool moms don't just care about products. We love products, but like, we love all the other stuff around parenting too. So I hope you all do as well. I really like this, Jordan. Thank you so much. It was really good to talk to you about this.
Yes.
Well, that's it. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Spawned. Huge thanks to our guest, Jordan Shapiro. Isn't he amazing? Yes. And also thanks to our engineer, John Bowen. He's pretty amazing too.
And if you've got a moment, please, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or honestly, wherever you listen. We would greatly appreciate it. You know, when you subscribe to our podcast, when you download the episodes, you know, even if you just click 5 stars, but of course we love hearing from you. You can always just type a few things in there. It doesn't take very long and it actually helps other listeners like you find us. And it's so easy.
Plus, it's a totally free way to support us.
Yes.
Which absolutely is really nice. Like, but hey, we're not charging you for this. What's free these days? Not much. That's all I can say.
$0.
Hey, speaking of free, you can also join us totally free in our Spawned podcast community on Facebook, where we chat about the show topics, pretty much anything else you'd like to talk about. We even talked about doing maybe a Spawned live, like with video in there.
Ooh.
Let us know if you'd be interested in something like that, because I think that would be kind of fun to do in the podcast page. So we could actually kind of see people back and they could see us and we could all talk together.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for listening to Spawned. This is Kristen.
And this is Liz. Have a great day.
Bye.